we're doing here today is groundbreaking. You know a better word for groundbreaking?
Good morning, everybody. This is the Morning Drive Show. Today, it's a special edition. It's the Morning Die Show because of my special guest, Dr. Jack Kevorkian. You might know him better as Dr. Death.
If a person's allowed to die, you do it quickly, painlessly. You don't let them wither away.
What would you charge for this procedure?
You don't charge people for something like this.
Jack, they're threatening to bring you up on murder charges.
Have the gall to charge Dr. Kevorkian tonight. Bring it on!
You're not a local quack anymore.
No!
You're America's quack.
America's quack!
I bailed you out. Let's go.
What kind of lawyer does that?
I should fire you.
Have you no religion? Have you no God?
He is leading society into an age of enlightenment, you idiot!
Who cares what people think? It's what my patient feels.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to Talk with Francesca, and that was a clip from You Don't Know Jack. With me here now is Dr. Marcia Angel. She's the former executive editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. She's now a senior lecturer in social medicine at Harvard Medical School. In 1997, Time magazine named her one of the 25 most influential Americans. She's a leading advocate for the Death with Dignity ballot initiative. She's put it this way: the highest ethical imperative of doctors should be to provide care in whatever way best serves patients' interests, in accord with each patient's wishes, not with a theoretical commitment to preserve life no matter what the cost and suffering. The greatest harm we can do is to consign a desperate patient to unbearable suffering, or force the patient to seek out a stranger like Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Dr. Angel, thank you for being on Talk with Francesca today.
It's my pleasure.
You obviously see the Death with Dignity Act as bringing the dying process to a merciful end.
Mm-hmm.
You were quoted as saying that you wish that your father had access to this fatal prescription. Can you tell the folks listening why?
Well, he ended his life in a violent way. He shot himself. And he knew that he was dying of cancer of the prostate. That he was going to have to go to the hospital the next day, where he would lose the option of ending his life. And so he did it the only way he could, which was to use the pistol that he kept in his bedside table.
Was that a surprise to you?
It was not a surprise in the sense that I knew that he was a man who valued his independence, his control.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't surprised, but I felt very sad about it because it meant that my mother had the shock of discovering him. And we all had a shock. So not really surprised because it was in character, but I was sad that he was driven to do it in that way.
Right. It does seem that people who, well, they say that people die just the same way that they live. And that,
yes, I think that's a good point.
And that when, you know, there's a type of person that really wants to be in control, this gives them the control that they're looking for. It also seems that people who have witnessed, you know, an agonizing, a bad illness are in favor of the Death with Dignity Act. Would you say that's accurate?
I don't know the statistics, but I do know that almost everyone has seen a bad death in their family. Just talking to people. Mm-hmm. And I think that does tend to make them feel that there ought to be another way. The statistics may show that. I just don't know.
Do you think that actually, when it comes to actually exercising the right to die, do you think that even after someone has asked for the prescription, that they're likely to go through with it?
Well, we have good statistics from Oregon.
Right. I was going to ask you about the laboratory in Oregon, if you will.
It is quite a laboratory.
Yes, exactly.
They have been using their Death with Dignity Act, which is the template for the one that would be before the Massachusetts voters in November.
Mm-hmm.
They have had that in use since 1997.
Right.
So that is a very long experience, and the Department of Health in Oregon keeps very careful records of who uses it, who gets the prescription, who takes the drugs. the reasons that people give for wanting to hasten their death in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So we know a lot about it. We also know that in Oregon, with each passing year, the law grows more popular.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think that is?
Well, I think they see how well it works and mm-hmm. that all of the fears and concerns have simply not been borne out. It's been used for 15 years now, mm-hmm. exactly as intended. It still is responsible for only a small percentage of deaths there.
Right.
I think it's something like 1 in 500 deaths, or 0.2%. That's not very much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there,
right.
And so people who need it can avail themselves of it. Now, in answer to your question, what the data in Oregon show is that about two-thirds of the people who get the prescription according to the law, and there are a lot of safeguards,
mm-hmm. Right.
About two-thirds of those people actually use it to end their lives. But one-third don't.
Well, in some ways, I would think that it might be somewhat reassuring just to know that they could if they were so desperate. That
absolutely.
And, you know, sometimes it's just like someone, who they entertain suicide, you know, almost as a way to sort of fantasize, as a way to get out of their emotional pain. And yet sometimes they don't, you know, but sometimes it can be, I suppose, reassuring just to know that there is an out.
Yes, I think that's true. I would say that this is really not very much like what we think of in ordinary suicides.
Right.
Because these people are going to die imminently anyway.
All right.
And so it's not a choice between life and death. It's a choice between a slightly earlier, more peaceful death.
All right.
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry about that.
Yeah.
So it's a choice of a slightly mm-hmm. earlier, more peaceful death.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, what you say is true,
mm-hmm.
That having that available
right.
for a third of the patients in mm-hmm. Oregon gave them a sense of peace and security.
Peace. And at that point in their lives, I mean, it's something that the least that we can do to help them to you know, go through what they're on their way to going through.
Yes, and you know, in the case of my father,
mm-hmm.
I think he had perhaps at least 6 months to live.
Oh, goodness, okay.
He was not destined to die within days or weeks.
Mm.
I think if he had been able to keep those pills
mm.
on his bedside table, he would have lived longer.
Oh, that's
and I think that's probably true for a lot of people
right.
in Oregon, that
knowing.
Gives them, in a sense, the feeling that they have control.
Keep going. They have some sense
right,
of control
right.
over something. I mean,
exactly.
Oftentimes when people are dying, they lose so much control. You know, so many different
and,
ways.
And they worry that they might not be able
right.
to use it
mm-hmm.
if they wait too long.
Just to get on the ballot, we had to collect, 69,000 votes, and wasn't something like 84,000 collected?
I don't remember the exact figures, but we had
signatures
many more than we needed.
Right. So obviously, it sounds like that Massachusetts people are for this.
Oh, I think there's no question about it. I was coming out of Trader Joe's
mm-hmm.
one time, and I saw one of the women collecting signatures, and I said, are you finding it easy? And she said they practically run over each other to me to sign it. The problem is that as we get closer to the election,
right.
I think there'll be a lot of fear-mongering.
Yeah.
And I think that people worry about it. They worry that if there's so much if there's so much opposition mm. that they might be missing something about it.
Right.
And the opposition often talks in terms of killing people, which this is most certainly not.
Right.
But I think that some people might lose the strength of their conviction.
Conviction, exactly.
With that.
Well, yeah. So what do you project the chemistry to be this fall? Do you think that, so are you saying that you think that because there'll be the people who are opposing it, that they'll scare off the ones that thought they had a concrete decision made?
Those who lean in favor of it, who have seen bad deaths, who mm-hmm. say, I never want that to happen to me, and yet have not gone through the details sufficiently or studied what's happened in Oregon and Washington State, where they also have the law, mm-hmm. that they can be worried. Mm-hmm. And so if you ask me to look into my crystal ball, mm-hmm. I think it'll pass, but I think it'll be close.
Okay, good. Let me just ask you a totally different question here. Mm-hmm. Could it be possible that the law will encourage patients to act too soon? You know, sometimes, and I mean, it's not often, but, you know, sometimes it's patients that are very near death and then they rally and come around. I mean, we've all heard of the patient with 6 months to live and then they're alive years later. And so... It might be a concern, like, where do you draw that line? So how would you respond to someone who had that concern?
Well, it's a matter of choice both for the patient and for the physician.
Mm-hmm.
And most physicians who are asked to prescribe the medication for patients in Oregon don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
They're concerned about psychiatric problems that cloud their judgment, the patient's judgment.
Mm-hmm.
They're concerned that they want to act too soon. So you do have that safety, and you need two physicians who I think would be very sensitive to patients moving too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the end of the day, nothing is foolproof.
Well,
nothing is foolproof.
Absolutely.
And although we've heard of such patients who have been given 6 months to live and are, you know, singing and dancing 10 years later,
mm-hmm.
not many of us have actually met one.
Well, actually, I do know one, but it was very unusual situation. But you're right; it is not very often that.
And so, what you have on the one side is the possibility of somebody acting too quickly,
right.
And the certainty that people will suffer horribly and want to obtain some release from it and
mm-hmm.
can't. So I don't have any problems in balancing those two things.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Talk with Francesca, and I'm here with Dr. Marcia Angel. I have a question that's come in from the website. John from Dorchester, he says, most people don't realize you don't own your body, so you have no right to commit suicide. I know this runs contrary to what we've been hearing, especially for the feminists, re-abortion. But if you believe in God and that God made you and forbids suicide, you don't own your own body. Well, obviously, this is a religious...
It's a religious doctrine, and he's welcome to it.
It's a religious component, right. Okay, here is another one. Cecile from Somerville, don't you think you are contributing to a culture of death by advocating this?
No, because as I said, these people are dying.
Mm-hmm.
By definition, they're dying.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm trying to contribute to is a culture of self-determination.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it... I find it unseemly for people who are suffering and desperately want to end that suffering a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I find it unseemly to tell them no, that you must soldier on because we want you to soldier on, and that your own feelings in the matter don't have any consequence. So. There are two things that I care about here. One is the relief of suffering,
mm-hmm.
and the second is respect for patients' autonomy, for their self-determination. It's not for an outsider, that is anyone except the patient,
mm-hmm.
to say how much suffering is too much.
Right. You don't think that this is I'm just sort of playing the devil's advocate here.
Sure.
But do you think that there are people who think death with dignity laws are a dangerous slope towards euthanasia?
I do think that is, I'm not so sure it's the legitimate fear, but it is a rhetoric. It is it is what is said.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the thing about physician-assisted suicide as opposed to euthanasia is that by definition, it must be voluntary.
Right.
It must be voluntary because you have to swallow a lot of nasty stuff.
Well, sometimes people feel, they do feel that they're a burden. You know, I'm just sort of going on the other side. Sometimes people feel they're a burden to, oftentimes when someone is very sick, they feel they're a burden to the people
yes.
that are caring for them. And that's sad. And that would be a sad reason for them to take this.
It's sad, but the safeguards already determine that they're within 6 months,
mm-hmm.
plus or minus a very little,
mm-hmm.
of dying of their disease.
Mm-hmm.
That's already been determined.
Well, yeah, and, you know, in some ways, you know, I'm wondering, aren't the medical institutions anyway doing this just by amping up the morphine and slowing down the oxygen?
Well, that's the other thing I was going to say. When people talk about this as a slippery slope to euthanasia,
yeah.
For many years,
mm-hmm.
we have recognized the legal right
mm-hmm.
of patients to withdraw life-sustaining treatment, to remove themselves from a ventilator, to stop dialysis, to stop any treatment they please.
Mm-hmm.
And we have also recognized the right of their proxies to do the same thing. So that there are many patients that are no longer aware,
mm-hmm.
are no longer capable of making their own decision, whose proxies, for the best of reasons, remove them from life-sustaining treatment. Now, that is much more vulnerable to abuse.
Yeah, I agree.
I would agree with that.
Than
physician-assisted suicide.
Yep. Okay. All right. Dr. Marcia Angel, thank you so much for being on Talk with Francesca today. I really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome,
okay.
Francesca.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Last but not least, here with me now on the telephone is Heather Klisch. She is going to share with us the story of how her father, who is from the state of Oregon, chose to die.
Heather Klisch, thank you for being on Talk with Francesca today.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Heather, you are very much in favor of the Death with Dignity Act. Can you tell our listeners why?
Well, I believe from my own experience with my father that it is a compassionate thing to do, to give people the option that the Death with Dignity Act provides when they are in their last days.
So can you tell us a story about what happened with your dad?
My dad was diagnosed with a terminal form of brain cancer in the fall of 2010. When he received his diagnosis, saw the doctors were very consistent and very clear that radiation and chemotherapy could certainly extend his life,
mm-hmm.
but the tumor was inoperable, and they gave us a pretty definitive time frame for how long he was expected to live.
How long was that?
Well, they told us that it would be certainly less than a year at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And after he went through chemotherapy and radiation, and he did that in Massachusetts because he and my mom were visiting me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
When he was diagnosed, he was in a condition such that he was unable to travel home. So he stayed here for rehabilitation and chemotherapy and radiation. And after Christmas time, when he and my mom traveled home, at that point,
Oregon? Is that where?
Home to Oregon, where the death with dignity option is available to residents. He knew at that time that he wanted to have that choice available to him. And so at that time, he knew and he was told that his life expectancy was less than 6 months. So he went through the full process and all of the safeguards of obtaining a prescription.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure, I can. He made the request back up a little bit. He made a verbal request twice,
mm-hmm.
to a physician, and interestingly enough, just like the act proposed to Massachusetts to provide, that when he first asked his own physician, his family physician was able to say, no, this goes against my religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
I can't write you with the prescription, but referred him to another physician who he thought probably would be able to.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad made that request once.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a 15-day waiting period, also got filled out paperwork to make the request in writing, had two dear friends witness his signature, and then made the verbal request a second time in order to have a prescription written and then filled. It took probably about 8 weeks just to go through that old process from mm-hmm. start to finish.
How did you feel about that? How did you feel while this was all going on? Did you have mixed emotions or that he had made this decision that this is the way he wanted to end his life?
Well, first, my feelings were first and foremost dominated by the terrible sadness and grief
right.
I felt that my father had a terminal illness. And
right.
Of course, that is primarily what I felt.
Mm-hmm.
My family is a family, and our relationships are all very much built on respect for each other
mm-hmm.
And for the choice that we make for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So when my dad very first started talking to me and my sisters and my mom about his desire to make use of this option, or at least to have the option available to him,
mm-hmm.
we respected that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fundamentally how I felt about it.
Mm-hmm.
My grief was over losing my dad, and that is something that was certainly going to happen and did happen.
Mm-hmm. And how was your mother with all of this? Does she feel the same way that you did, that although it was tremendously sad that this was his wish, his final wishes, and that was okay with her?
I can't speak perfectly for my mother. I can mm-hmm. only speak really for my own feelings, but mm-hmm. my mom also has told me that yes, their marriage was a marriage that was also based on respect.
Mm-hmm.
And when he made it clear that these were his wishes, she has told me that she felt like that was her final act of respect toward him, was respecting mm-hmm. his wishes that way.
Why did he have this wish? I mean, he still had not a lot of time, but 6 months is not short. I mean, it's not like it's 2 weeks or you know, even 2 months. He still had 6 months left to live. Did you ask him why he was choosing this, or was it just that you made the decision? He made the decision, then you were going to respect it.
Well, something to be clear about, at least in my dad's case, when he made this choice, he didn't make a choice to say, wow, I've got 6 months left to live. I think I'm going to exercise this option now.
Mm-hmm.
He made a decision that he wanted to have that option available to him. And to do that, he had to go through the process and take the time to go through the process to have that option available to him. And he wrote about it, and we talked about it, and he wrote about it in an email to a friend, where my dad, especially in his later years, came to live his life very deliberately,
mm-hmm.
And living in a way, it was very important to him to live and be and act in a manner that was consistent with how he wanted to be. And even though doctors described what the end would be like, you know, none of us really knew what it was going to be like. He had a form of brain cancer that was impairing the ability of his body to function.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just pain. It was impairing the ability of his body to function. Certainly impairing his quality of life. And yes, the treatment did extend his life. I mean, after Christmas, he was able to make a trip down to California to mm-hmm. see his newborn grandson. So mm-hmm. he
was able to rally a little bit.
He is someone who wanted to live, but mm-hmm. he also knew that when the end came, he wasn't choosing between living and dying. He was choosing the manner in which he death was one thing that was certain.
Mm-hmm.
And when he ultimately exercised this option, he was bedridden.
Mm-hmm.
He was sore. It
mm-hmm.
hurt to laugh.
Okay.
He couldn't read. He couldn't watch TV. We could converse, but it was difficult for him.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere in there, he crossed a personal line that
mm-hmm.
he had set, and I do believe it's something that must mm-hmm. be very individual.
And very personal,
and very personal for how he, not even so much for how he wanted to live, but how he wanted to die.
That's an important distinction. I appreciate you letting the listeners really understand that, because I think that's really important. We've been talking about that today, and I think that is very, very important. Heather, is there anything, we just have less than a minute left, I'm just wondering, is there anything that you'd like to tell the folks listening before we say goodbye?
Probably not. There's a lot. There's a lot to the story.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you know, with the what I also learned through my dad's experience, and the statistics tell us this also, is that death with dignity is not an option that everybody chooses.
Mm-hmm.
The Death with Dignity Act would not mandate that anybody choose it or that anybody prescribe.
Mm-hmm.
What it does is it allows people to have an option when death is near and death is unavoidable. And it is about that, not so much a choice between whether living or dying.
Mm-hmm. Heather Klisch, thank you so much for sharing your story. I appreciate it, and being on Talk with Francesca today.
All right, thank you.
Okay, it's time to wrap things up now. It went so fast. If you want to know more about what's ahead on Talk with Francesca, you can visit my website, talkwithfrancesca.com, and click on upcoming shows. And of course, if you missed some of the show today, it'll be posted on my website. It always is. You don't have to wait until next week to contact me. Send me an email at host@talkwithfrancesca.com or visit me on Facebook at Talk with Francesca. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you have a fantastic weekend. It's going to be beautiful. And as always, I hope I gave you something to talk about. Something tells me I'm sure I did. Don't try.